For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. Shalom, and welcome to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions in Hickson, Tennessee. I am Aaron Broughton, your host for today, sitting in for Mr. John Lawrence. Over the years, there has been much debate about the reality that there ever was a King David. This biblical person is well loved by both Jewish and Christian communities. David was a shepherd who became king over Israel. He was a warrior poet who is beloved of God. Now, even though the Bible has much to say about him, there's been little physical evidence that King David actually existed, at least to the magnitude that the Bible records. Several scholars and critics believe that David's legacy has been exaggerated and say that he was merely a bandit who had a small following. In fact, they kind of call him the Israeli Robin Hood of the day. Well, in 1993, the House of David Stela, or stone, was found at the biblical site of Tel Dan in northern Israel. Now, engraved on the stone was an inscription referring to the House of David. This was the first evidence outside the Bible that David actually existed. This find, I believe, is one of the top archaeological finds in Israel. You can actually see this for yourself at the Israeli Museum in Jerusalem today. Now, archaeologists have continued their search for the historic King David. Now, if you go just about 20 miles west of Jerusalem, you'll come to the Valley of Elah, where David fought and defeated Goliath of Gath. Here is the ruins of Kirbet Kayafa that have been uncovered. Here is a 3,000-year-old palace that was discovered dating from 1020 BC to 980 BC. Now, archaeologists understood the dating of the site based on the burned olive pits discovered through carbon-14 dating. This means that this place is from the time of King David. Hebrew University professor Yosef Garfinkel, along with Sa'ar Ganor from the Israeli Antiquities Authority, led the excavation and discovery of what they call the two largest buildings known to have existed in the 10th century BC in the kingdoms of Judah. One building, in fact, measured 100 feet long in a central area of the site, and it was adorned with several elegant imported vessels. Garfinkel commented on the significance of this place, saying, "There is no question that the ruler of the city sat here, and when King David came to visit the hills, he slept here." The other structure, a pillared storeroom, features hundreds of storage jars stamped with an official seal, as was customary in the Kingdom of Judah for centuries. Another special find is a pottery shard that has the oldest Hebrew inscription to date. It's not Canaanite, it's not Phoenician. In fact, it has very specific letters that are only found in the Hebrew alphabet. Something, though, that is missing from this place is a lack of pig bones that were used by Canaanites and other groups. This means that those who lived here probably observed a special dietary restrictions from pork. Now, all these clues point to the fact that this was not a Canaanite, Phoenician, or even a Philistine settlement. Just to compare, 20% of bones discovered at nearby Philistine sites were pig bones. Also, no graven images of other gods or people that were common among cultic worship were found. As the archaeologists excavated Kirbet Kayafa, they also uncovered special clay and limestone models of a temple. Now, this is interesting because the detailed design on the models point to a special interest of a people who were religious but did not worship many gods, but rather only one god. This shows us that these amazing features, they compare to Solomon's temple mentioned in the Bible to these unique designs. These models fit the biblical account that a temple did exist in Jerusalem, just like the Bible describes. This really makes the Bible come to life. In a larger picture, the finds at Kirbet Kayafa tell us that this place was built under the nose of the Philistines in the Valley of Elah. Now, the palace that was found here really is more of an administrative building that perhaps housed King David at some point. As King David's kingdom grew, this place served as a strategic outpost and fortification in his government. Now, as we remember the life of David, we also look at prophecy concerning the Messiah in Isaiah 9 and verse 7, where it says, "Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forevermore. This future promise should excite us to see the finding from the time of King David with a view of the coming of the Son of David, Jesus the Messiah. Let us look forward to that day. Now with this in mind, let's open our Bibles and our hearts as we study together with our teacher and Jewish believer, Brother Mark Oshman.
Welcome back to our radio broadcast. In this session, our survey will cover the Old Testament books of Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. The title of Ecclesiastes derived from a Greek word meaning one who assembles. It directly translated the Hebrew title, Koheleth. The English rendering of this term is preacher. Many commentators believe that Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes. They point to various phrases about the author that also would describe Solomon. In the opening chapter, for example, the author referred to himself as, quote, the son of David, unquote, and, quote, king in Jerusalem, unquote. Chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes revealed that the writer had engaged in extensive building projects and had acquired great wealth. Nonetheless, the name of Solomon never appears throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. The overriding theme presented by the writer of this book was that, apart from God, no human endeavors have any lasting value. He repeatedly exclaimed, quote, all is vanity, unquote. The author developed his argument by showing how all of his attempts, whether planting vineyards or indulging himself in sensual pleasures, how all of his attempts ultimately proved useless. The preacher had everything that a human being could ever desire. However, all of his efforts only brought him despair. He opined that, quote, there is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor, unquote. The author began chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes with this statement, quote, to everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven. He did not seek to blur the distinctions between good and evil. Instead, his words implied that, in the final analysis, both constructive and destructive activities had a place in human endeavors. The author also wrote these words, quote, better is an handful with quietness than both the hands full with travail and vexation of spirit, unquote. That observation anticipated Paul's statement in 1 Timothy that, quote, godliness with contentment is great gain, unquote. The preacher warned against accumulating wealth, alluding to such a practice as vanity. Jesus Christ said much the same thing when he asked, what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? In the 6th chapter of Ecclesiastes, the writer asks, quote, who knoweth what is good for man in this life? All the days of his vain life which he spendeth as a shadow? Unquote. Both prosperity and adversity form part of the human condition. Sometimes a wicked person excelled, sometimes a fool attained to honor, sometimes a righteous man suffered degradation. Nonetheless, as the preacher stated, all things come alike to all. The author of Ecclesiastes believed that wisdom conferred greater lasting benefits than either wealth or strength did. Thus, anyone who behaved prudently had a better chance of succeeding in life than someone who merely, in the preacher's words, quote, observeth the wind, unquote. Nonetheless, the author reaffirmed his conviction, quote, all that cometh is vanity, unquote. The preacher concluded the book of Ecclesiastes by exhorting his audience to remember God while they were young, before the hardships associated with old age set in. In a single sentence, he summarized his opinion about man's responsibilities to God. Quote, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Unquote. In the final analysis, the author regarded obeying God as the primary mandate for the human race. We now turn our attention to the Song of Solomon. The author of 1 Kings had attributed over 1,000 songs to Solomon. This work might be one of them. Either Solomon wrote the words himself, or he commissioned someone else to do it for him. In either case, the title, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, The title implied that Solomon himself published it. Commentators have offered different opinions of this book. Some regard it as a literal narrative involving a woman known as the Shulamite. Other observers saw the Song of Solomon as an allegorical expression of the intimate relationship that existed between God and the Jewish people. Still other commentators interpreted the book as depicting the relationship between Jesus Christ and his church. Those who believe that the Song of Solomon described an actual romance tend to disagree as to how many main characters appear in the narrative. Did the Song of Solomon refer to two people, that is, a woman and Solomon? Did it refer to three people, a woman, her beloved, and Solomon? The beloved's ease of access to the woman hinted that Solomon himself was her companion. Yet other verses, which referred to Solomon in the third person singular, suggested that the beloved person identified a man other than Solomon. The Song of Solomon itself allows for either interpretation. A variety of metaphors and similes appeared throughout this book. The Shulamite described herself as, quote, the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys, unquote. She compared her beloved's hair to, quote, the most fine gold, unquote. He, in turn, alluded to the woman as a garden and as a fountain. The Song of Solomon began with the woman and her beloved expressing their longings for one another. She called him, quote, thou whom my soul loveth, unquote. In response, he labeled her as the fairest among women. The woman confidently affirmed, quote, my beloved is mine, and I am his, unquote. Her beloved cried out to her, quote, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. He compared her to a garden. A separation between the pair brought heartache to the woman. She went out and sought for him until she found him. When she did find him, she refused to let him leave her. In the fourth chapter of the song, the beloved effusively praised the woman. Quote, thou art all fair, my love, there is no spot in thee, unquote. She responded by inviting him to, quote, come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits, unquote. The nature of the language employed suggested the existence of an intimate relationship between the two. On one occasion, the Shulamite refused to welcome her beloved because she had already gone to bed. When she finally opened the door to him, she found out that he had departed. Her search for him brought her suffering, both from those called watchmen and from her own wounded heart. Reunited with her companion, the woman proclaimed, quote, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, unquote. The man again lauded her for her beauty, declaring, quote, how fair and how pleasant art thou, O love, for delights, unquote. She stated in response that, quote, I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me, unquote. She wished that he were like her brother, so that they could openly display their affection for one another, without either of them experiencing shame. The Song of Solomon contained this emphatic statement, quote, love is strong as fire. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which hath a most vehement flame, unquote. It's interesting to note that in the Hebrew language, the word rendered most vehement has a form similar to one employed for a name of God. The author's use of this instruction could refer back to the statement found in Deuteronomy 4, quote, the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God, unquote. Another declaration in the Song of Solomon noted that, quote, many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it, unquote. At the end of the song, the woman compared herself to a vineyard bearing fruit. She cried out, quote, make haste, my beloved, and be thou like to a roe or to a young hart upon the mountains of spices, unquote. This concludes another radio broadcast. We invite you to return for future Bible studies.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee, 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.